today, it seems he gets competitive advantage out of this move.
I want to bring in our next guest. President Trump's return to the White House comes 15 years to the week after the U.S. Supreme Court issued its landmark Citizens United ruling, which opened the floodgates for billionaires like Elon Musk to pour unlimited money into elections. At Trump's inauguration on Monday, Elon Musk was given a prime seat along with Meta's Mark Zuckerberg, Amazon's Jeff Bezos, Apple's Tim Cook, Google's Sundar Pichai. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders commented, when the three wealthiest men in America sit behind Trump at his inauguration, everyone understands that the billionaire class now controls our government, unquote. We go now to Brendan Fischer, Deputy Executive Director at Documented, lawyer with expertise in campaign finance and government transparency issues. He has a new article out today in Rolling Stone, headlined Blame the Supreme Court for Elon Musk's Power in Trump's Administration. Talk about the significance of this week, Brendan, the 15th anniversary of Citizens United. And for people who don't understand what it is, trace the trajectory of the Supreme Court decision right through to the power of Elon Musk in the White House today.
Sure. And thank you for having me, Amy and Juan. So everything that Rob Weissman just described is entirely accurate. And it's a result. Musk's astonishing influence over Trump and this new administration, you know, is not just a result of his right wing celebrity, his personal wealth, his ownership of X. It's largely attributable to Musk having poured over $250 million into the 2024 election cycle. And almost all of that spending would have been impossible before Citizens United. Citizens United struck down limits on quote-unquote independent political spending, and it opened the door to super PACs that and dark money groups that billionaires like Musk have used to pour this astonishing amount of money into U.S. elections. And Musk's ability to translate his economic power into political power is what offers him this very privileged and powerful position in the incoming administration. And that's going to benefit Musk, and the rest of us are likely to pay the price.
And Brendan, I think Open Secrets reported that about more than 40% of the total money raised by Trump came from just 10 individuals in the country. Have we ever experienced a presidency so beholden to such a small group of people?
This is unprecedented. It's certainly true that every election cycle since the 2010 Citizens United decision has been more expensive than the last. Democrats and Republicans have both embraced super PACs and embraced the mega donors that fund them. But Trump is taking this to another level. As you said, over 44% of the money raised to support Trump came from just 10 donors, and Musk being one of the top few. And you know, that's not something we've seen before. We've not seen that level of disproportionate spending from just a handful of wealthy billionaires.
So Brendan Fischer, if you can talk about Elon Musk's power right now, spent more than $277 million on getting Trump elected through his super PACs, and where he stands right now.
Right. Well, I think Rob Weissman described it very well. Musk has this, semi-formal position in the U.S. government. He has already used his formal and informal power to derail a bipartisan spending deal at the end of last year. His personal wealth has ballooned by over $170 billion in just the month following the election, with investors taking the view that his companies are going to do very well under a Trump administration, given that Musk has so much influence over that Trump administration. He's likely to continue to receive federal contracts, perhaps receive even more federal contracts. The Musk's companies that are heavily regulated or under criminal investigation are likely to receive a light touch under the Trump administration, and his power is now even going global. Musk has begun to meddle in European political affairs, and global leaders are taking that meddling seriously because of the perception or the reality that Musk has influence over the new president. So I think many global leaders are looking at statements from Musk and wondering whether it's actually a statement from Trump or whether a Musk statement about global affairs is going to be adopted by the incoming Trump administration. And again, this is a power that is attributable to Musk's ability to pour over $250 million into the 2024 election, which is a direct result of the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision.
And Brendan, you noted that that former President Biden used his farewell address to warn the country of the country veering toward an oligarchy. Yet what did Biden do during his presidency to restrain the influence of money in politics?
Not much. Biden's statements about the power of the growing oligarchy and the growing tech oligarchy were certainly welcome, and they were accurate. But Biden himself did very little during his administration to limit money's influence on politics. There were no executive orders to crack down on dark money or require contractors to disclose their political spending. And one of the most effective or direct things that a president can do to limit money's influence on politics or to enforce the laws limiting money's influence on politics is to appoint commissioners to the Federal Election Commission. And the one Democrat that Biden nominated to the Federal Election Commission actually sided with the Republicans in this key advisory opinion that came out last year that allowed super PACs to coordinate with campaigns on certain canvassing and other activities. And it's that advisory opinion that allowed Elon Musk's super PAC to take over some central campaign operations from the Trump campaign. It allowed the Trump campaign to outsource key campaign operations to this Musk-funded super PAC, which further amplified Musk's political influence. So, Biden's legacy in many ways on money and politics is one of deregulation. It's on his watch that the FEC has really accelerated this deregulatory turn and has allowed even more money and even more unregulated money to flow into the U.S. political system.
A part of what President Biden said last week in his farewell address when warning about the dangers of what he called the tech industrial complex.
We see the same dangers, the concentration of technology, power and wealth. His farewell address, President Eisenhower spoke of the dangers of the military-industrial complex. He warned us then about, and I quote, the potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power, end of quote. Six decades later, I'm equally concerned about the potential rise of a tech-industrial complex that could pose real dangers for our country as well.
For more on the growing alignment between Trump and Silicon Valley, we're joined from San Francisco by Becca Lewis. She's a postdoctoral scholar at Stanford University. Her research focuses on right-wing influence in Silicon Valley. Becca, welcome to Democracy Now! You just finished your PhD on this very subject. I think decades ago, people were associating Silicon Valley and big tech with certainly not the right and the far right. Can you talk about the change?
Yeah, that's right. Thank you so much for having me. What I found in my research is that even though it hasn't been part of our public understanding of Silicon Valley, there actually has been a really important right-wing strain in Silicon Valley for decades at this point. And a lot of what we're seeing right now is that coming to fruition, really reaching an apex rather than emerging out of nowhere.
And talk about those forces in the 1970s, 80s, 90s.
Yeah, so at that time, there was a lot of right-wing backlash against the gains of particularly feminism and fear around the breakdown of the nuclear family, or at least the perceived breakdown of the nuclear family. And there was a loose network of right-wing thinkers, writers, public intellectuals who came to see Silicon Valley as a space to restore the role of masculinity in the American economy through this ideal of entrepreneurship. And they really promoted entrepreneurs as preternaturally gifted men who should not be held to society's other standards, rules, or regulations. And this was at a time when women and people of color were entering, universities and institutions of higher learning at higher rates than ever before. And these groups of social reactionary men were promoting the idea that entrepreneurship could do away with all of that. You wouldn't need education anymore because the entrepreneurs would be the ones to save us.
There is a leader in this movement.
But Becca, also this whole issue of the Silicon Valley folks, for the most part, were not as involved in national politics until recent years. Does this shift to some degree reflect the fact that the Biden administration began to become more assertive in anti-monopoly and antitrust efforts against Silicon Valley?
Yes, absolutely. There certainly have been these reactionary strains within Silicon Valley, but you also have seen that, the Obama administration, for example, was very, very welcoming to Silicon Valley and fostering it. And so you saw a lot of folks within Silicon Valley working, really happily with the Obama administration. And I think that's partly where we started to get this public perception that Silicon Valley was actually left-wing, when in fact a lot of what was happening was just symbiosis and Silicon Valley being able to do what they wanted. Once they started facing pushback, there was a reaction against these more progressive forces and or regulatory forces at the very least. And now you see a wholehearted embrace of Trump with the hopes of deregulation.
Also, President Trump announced yesterday a $500 billion joint venture known as Stargate between OpenAI, SoftBank, and Oracle in order to invest in an artificial intelligence power infrastructure. Could you talk about that and Trump's efforts to rescind Biden's executive order on AI?
Yes, this was a really big statement that the Trump administration would be friendly, would be deregulatory, would do everything to help out the tech titans who are promoting AI above all else. This is where we could see really the coziness emerging, even more than all of the tech titans in the front row at the inauguration. And it's really telling that one of the tech titans who is working with Trump in this effort is Larry Ellison, who's been one of the biggest right-wing forces in Silicon Valley since the 1980s, and also who has been a longtime Trump loyalist.
Becca Lewis, Google, Meta, Apple all face antitrust lawsuits. Musk companies are under a number of investigations, reviews by federal agencies. As Trump's second term begins, does he have leverage over these influential tech leaders, or are they completely running the show? And the significance of not only, the head of Meta, Zuckerberg, and of course, Elon Musk, right? They're all ahead of the cabinet members or the proposed cabinet members at the inauguration. But the CEO of TikTok was there as well.
Yes, absolutely. Trump has leverage over them and they have leverage over him. I think you're seeing a symbiotic relationship, but one in which they realize that there's power that each can gain from the other. For Trump, he really benefits from getting to attach his name to what seems like the forward-thinking next wave innovative elements of Silicon Valley, whereas the tech titans themselves know that he actually holds the power around regulation and government intervention. And so you really are seeing them cozy up to each other in a way that is driven both by aligned interests, but also by mutual fear.
Becca Lewis, I want to thank you for being with us. Postdoctoral scholar at Stanford University, just finished her PhD, her current research focusing on right-wing influence in Silicon Valley. Thanks also to Robert Weissman of Public Citizen and Brendan Fisher of Documented. Brendan will also link to your new article in Rolling Stone, Blame the Supreme Court for Elon Musk's Power in Trump's Administration. Coming up, Ravi Ragbir is back. In the last days of President Biden's tenure as president, he pardoned the immigrant rights leader. Stay with us.
Desafiantes, ingobernables, no le tememos y no pararemos. Por nuestra liberación nos dedicamos, porque nuestros futuros están vidas negras importan.
Las vidas negras importan.
Ningún ser humano es ilegal.
Ningún ser humano es ilegal.
Justicia reproductiva.
Justicia reproductiva.
¡Que viva Palestina!
¡Que viva Palestina!
No es mi presidente. Él no representa la voz de mi gente. Si están conmigo, pues digan presente. Me dicen, no es mi presidente. No es
No es mi presidente, not my president, by Taina Asili, a remix version of the same song from 2017 that was released Monday. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to a discussion of efforts to push back against the Trump administration's anti-immigrant agenda. The Department of Homeland Security said Tuesday it's allowing federal immigration agents to conduct raids at schools, houses of worship, and hospitals, ending a years-long policy that banned ICE agents from arresting people at these locations. This comes a day after President Trump signed a series of executive orders on Inauguration Day, which included declaring a national emergency at the southern border, launching mass raids and deportations, restricting federal funds from sanctuary cities, and ending birthright citizenship, which is protected by the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment. On Tuesday, a coalition of 24 Democratic-led states and cities filed a lawsuit in federal court to block Trump's executive order attempting to end birthright citizenship. For more, we're joined by three guests, three leading advocates for immigrant rights here in New York. Longtime immigrant rights advocate Ravi Ragbir is back in our studio. After nearly 20 years of fighting his own deportation, he was granted a pardon by President Biden on Sunday, a day before Biden left office. We're also joined by Amy Gottlieb, Ravi's wife and U.S. Migration Director for American Friends Service Committee, and Alina Das, lawyer and professor at New York University School of Law, where she is co-director of the NYU Immigrant Rights Clinic, part of Ravi's legal team. So we're going to go large on the issue of immigration in a moment, but I want to hear the moment that you heard. First of all, Ravi Ragbir, it was so hard for you to even speak to Fridays ago when you were here as you waited news in your own case. You're so busy always advocating for others. How did you find out you got a pardon?
So I was that whole day on Saturday, and I come to Saturday because that's when we heard. I was in a funk, very depressed, and I was lowering my expectations, saying we will never get it. We will never get it. And at 9 o'clock in the night, We got a call from Melina, Amy and I, and Amy got the call and she put Alina on speaker. And every time we get usually when we get calls from Melina, it's like, oh my God, what's next? What is going to happen that we're going to have to be worried about? Alina was in tears because she had just gotten that call from the White House stating that her client, who is me, is going to get the part.
How did Alina talk about where you were when you got the call? You've worked so hard on this for so long.
Yes, well, Ravi has been working hard for the past 19 years fighting his deportation. I've been his lawyer for the last 17 years, and it was incredible. It was at home with my children when I got this call from a 202 number, ran upstairs to take it in quiet, and I really fell to my knees and sobbed.
What did they say?
They told me that my client would be getting a pardon, and they said that it was, you know, a credit to his fearless advocacy and the advocacy of so many who had spoken up for him over the years. And they acknowledged that we as an immigrant rights movement would be facing very hard times ahead. And I told the person from White House counsel that this news was the wind at our back.
Typically, what does the pardon do for him now and in terms of his case?
So Ravi faced deportation based on a single criminal conviction that he received 24 years ago. And our federal immigration laws, which have been incredibly harsh for a very long period of time, did not give him a safety valve. They did not give an immigration judge the ability to consider his family ties, the hardship of deportation, his contributions to the community before ordering his deportation. So what federal law did recognize was that a full and unconditional pardon of his conviction would eliminate those immigration consequences. So that's what we've received now. And this will allow him to live without fear of deportation, to live freely after all these years.
Can I add to that? So it is, people have asked me how I feel, right? I am numb because after all those years of living under this, I am numb because I have always had to steel myself against what was going to happen. But right from the next day on Monday is the absence of worrying about what is going to happen. And that there's a certain amount of freedom, there's a certain amount of lightening of the load. I feel so light and so free because I don't have to think about that possibility. All I can think about is living my life, but living my life working to stop what is happening to the thousands of families.
So let's talk about what's happening. There have been reports of imminent ICE raids across the country in Chicago and New York, which are sanctuary cities. How do you want and expect New York City officials to respond, including Mayor Eric Adams? It's very complicated. He went down to Mar-a-Lago. He met privately with Trump ahead of his inauguration, met with Trump's so-called border czar, Tom Homan, in December. What do you want to see now? I mean, Amy, you now are celebrating your husband's freedom here. He won't be deported to Trinidad and Tobago. But how, for example, is AFSC preparing and the information that has to get out to people all over the country?
Yeah. So we're doing a lot of what every organization is doing right now, is really kind of doubling down to make sure that we are connecting with people who feel like they're at risk. There's Know Your Rights presentations happening everywhere all the time. You know, people are upping their information, but it can't just be that, right? Like, we also are building out organizing work. We're making sure that people who are willing, or perhaps people who are not at risk, are willing to put themselves out there to support people who are at risk. So we're working, you know, collectively with the American Friends Service Committee is a Quaker organization. So we're really connecting with Quaker meetings that have concerns about immigrants in their communities. We're also having a lot of conversations across the border. We have offices in Latin America, in El Salvador and Guatemala and Mexico. So we're seeing what's happening right now in Tijuana, San Diego in particular, and making sure that we're able to support people who have family members who might be facing deportation here. So it's a host of things. But I think the key thing we want to be really super careful about is to not let ourselves go down a road where we're completely overwhelmed and can't function, right? We have to stay centered. We have to be able to hear what's happening, realize what the law does. So we are so grateful for all of our partner organizations that are filing lawsuits immediately. But there also needs to be a buildup on the ground, that community support, because the truth is that with the best legal counsel in the world, which we have, you also need community. And that's how Ravi got his pardon. And that is a light for all of us. And I'll say that, you know, just on a call I was on last night to share the story about Ravi getting the pardon is it's a little bit of light and energy for people as we're facing all the things that the administration is saying they're going to do. So we have to really stay calm, stay grounded, know that as much as what they're saying is ugly and horrible and racist and frightening, that we are on the right side of history, and we're going to be. We have to stay there.
And I'd like to ask Alina, Trump issued an executive order on Monday that would restrict federal funds from sanctuary cities and potentially take legal action against them. What is your sense of the state laws and clashing now with a federal policy and how that's going to work out?
This is something that we saw during the first Trump administration as well. And states and localities were able to fight back because the Constitution does protect states from being interfered with by the federal government. And I think what people need to keep in mind is that sanctuary laws, as they're described, really are just about ensuring that cities and states are actually fulfilling their residents' constitutional rights. The cities and states are not allowed to just hold people waiting for the federal government to come and pick them up. Many of the laws that are being attacked by the Trump administration are simply a recognition of people's constitutional rights to be free and to require the federal government to have a judicial warrant before they come and arrest people or enter into private properties. These are very fundamental things, and I think we're seeing the Trump administration widen its circle of pain and suffering, coming after cities and states who are, again, just abiding by the law, coming after U.S. citizens to take away their birthright citizenship, coming after churches and schools. I mean, this is wrong, and we need people to continue to stand up and fight back and protect everyone's constitutional rights.
Juan, we're here in New York, a sanctuary city. You're in Chicago, which until recently, a few days ago, was, everyone thought, ground zero, the first place for immigration raids. And then inexplicably, the czar, immigration czar, border czar, as they call him, Homan, said because of media leaks, they're not going to attack Chicago first. But he was the one who said it publicly. It wasn't the media. What is the feeling in Chicago right now?
Yeah, and I think he got ticked off that the information leaked out about the mobilizations and the plans for Chicago. But no doubt all of these major cities will soon confront the onslaught of agents coming in to round people up. So it's only a question of days, really.
So when it comes to New York, I mean, it's more complicated because the mayor in Chicago is really standing up against Trump. But the mayor of New York, who's under indictment himself, maybe he's seeking a pardon, I don't know, Mayor Adams, met with Trump and Homan. What are you demanding of him, Amy Gottlieb, Ravi Ragbir?
So we don't— The way I frame it, I don't care what he does or what he doesn't do. It is what the people have to do in the community of New York City. The city council stands up for the members of the residents. You know, even though de Blasio was a so-called people's, but he wasn't in the situation as Adams, the NYPD still worked actively with ICE, right? They worked actively to for my deportation in 2018. So, but what happened is everyone stood up, everyone stepped out. So people need to start connecting to the local organizations, the AFSC, any of the immigrant rights plus other groups.
Seconds.
Okay. So that we it is not what Mayor Adams have to do, what we have to do, Amy.
We're going to have to leave it there. Ravi Ragbir is with us, as well as his wife, Amy Gottlieb, who is with AFSC, and Alina Das at NYU. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Nous sommes bombardés d'informations erronées de toutes parts et il est difficile de savoir à qui faire confiance. Vous pouvez faire confiance aux voix que vous entendez sur cette station de radio et sur d'autres radiodiffuseurs communautaires. Nous avons besoin de vous pour écrire à votre député local pour lui expliquer pourquoi la radio locale est importante pour vous. Rendez-vous sur monirc.ca et découvrez comment vous pouvez contribuer à protéger l'avenir de la radio communautaire.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.